Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. How safe do people feel in their countries? Brian Lynn tells us in his report. Then, learn about American English with our Everyday Grammar program. But first, this report. Britain's interior minister says a poison used to sicken a British man and woman last week is the same one that sickened a former Russian spy and his daughter. Sajid Javid gave the latest report on the two people found unresponsive in the town of Amesbury. The two have been identified as 44-year-old Don Sturgis and 45-year-old Charlie Rowley. Javid said of the poisonous substance, "This has been identified as the same nerve agent that contaminated both Yulia and Sergei Skripal." The attack on the Skripals took place in March in the city of Salisbury. They were poisoned with Novichok, a nerve agent developed by the former Soviet Union. British Security Minister Ben Wallace spoke to the BBC on Thursday. He said investigators believe the new incident resulted from the earlier one that involved the Skripals. But he also said investigators do not believe that Sturgis and Rowley were meant to be targeted in the latest incident. Russia has denied any involvement in either incident. It has claimed that Britain is at fault and is seeking to create anti-Russian feelings. Russia said Thursday it had offered assistance to Britain with the Skripal investigation, but that Britain refused the offer. The incident resulted in the biggest expulsion of Russian diplomats since the Cold War. The United States and European allies took the side of Britain and blamed Russia for the incident. I'm Mario Ritter.
A new study takes a look at people's ratings of the safest and most dangerous places in the world. The American research company Gallup asked people to tell about their experiences with crime and law enforcement. Gallup says its researchers carried out the study last year in a total of 142 countries and areas. The researchers met with the individuals in person or spoke with them by telephone. People were asked these brief questions. 1. In the city or area where you live, do you have confidence in the local police force? 2. Do you feel safe walking alone at night in the city or area where you live? 3. Within the past 12 months, have you had money or property stolen from you or another household member? 4. Within the past 12 months, have you been assaulted or mugged? The findings were published in Gallup's 2018 Law and Order Index report. Singapore received the top rating in the study, 97 out of a possible 100. In this Southeast Asian nation, 94% of people questioned in 2017 said they felt safe walking alone in their neighborhood at night. 3 Northern European countries, Norway, Iceland, and Finland, were in a tie for second place. Each received a rating of 93. Results showed 93% of Norwegians reported feeling safe walking around alone at night. The Central Asian nation of Uzbekistan received the same rating as Hong Kong. They each had a score of 91. Switzerland and Canada tied at 90, while Indonesia received 89. 7 nations were next on the list with scores of 88. The 7 were Denmark, Slovenia, Luxembourg, Austria, China, the Netherlands, and Egypt. The United States received a rating of 84. That was the same score as the Czech Republic, Sweden, France, and Taiwan. At the bottom of the list was Venezuela, with a score of 44. The study noted that only 17% of the Venezuelans questioned said they felt safe walking alone at night. This was up from 12% in 2016. Afghanistan scored next lowest with 45. Just 20% of Afghans said they felt safe walking around alone at night. This was a drop from the 36% reported in 2016. In addition, the study found that Afghans' trust in local police fell from 68% in 2016 to 31% last year. I'm Brian Lynn.
In part one of this program, we told you many uses of wood in everyday speech. Today, we will talk about 2 more uses. We'll also look at some important elements of understanding this modal verb. Before we continue, though, let's do a short review exercise on what you learned in part one. Here's how the review will work. I will give you example sentences, and you will think about how each sentence uses would. The answer options are polite request, polite offer, reported speech, imaginary situation, or repeated past action. Listen carefully. I will use the shortened version of would in some of the sentences. It simply sounds like the letter D. For example, I would, shortened, is I'd. Okay, let's get started. Listen.
Every summer, we'd drive across the country to see family.
Would you like sugar and cream in your coffee?
She said that she would be there at 7 p.m.
If I were you, I'd bring a few bathing suits.
Hello, I'd like 2 tickets to New York.
Now that you have had a little practice, let's learn 2 more uses of would. The first usage is about willingness or lack of it. The word would can express someone's refusal to do something when used with the word not. For this meaning, we use will to talk about the future and would for the past. Listen to 2 examples. The first is about the future.
I'll ask my cousin to go to the concert, but he won't go.
The word won't is a contraction for will not. It shows that the speaker thinks their cousin will refuse to attend. Now, imagine that the speaker asked their cousin and the cousin was unwilling. Listen to the statement now with the word would.
I asked my cousin to go to the concert, but he wouldn't go.
In addition to people, this usage also applies to things. We know that non-living things cannot really refuse to do something. But we often express the malfunctioning of cars, computers, and other machines in this way. In these cases, would again acts as the past tense of will. Here is an example about a car with engine troubles.
Her car wouldn't start, so she took an Uber to work.
And here's one about computers.
I tried several times, but the program wouldn't open.
The past tense would shows that the people tried to use these things, but they did not operate correctly. Okay, let's move to the next usage. In part 1, we told you that English speakers often use indirect language to be polite. Indirect language can also soften the sometimes critical sound of opinions, suggestions, or reactions. Listen to 2 examples for comparison. The first one without would.
I suggest that you read customer reviews before buying a new computer.
And now with would.
I'd suggest that you read customer reviews before buying a new computer.
The word would helps this piece of advice sound more like a suggestion than a command. Notice that the main verb is suggest, a verb we often use for giving advice. The other common verbs for this usage of would are say, recommend, think, imagine, and advise. Here's another example, this one with advise.
I'd advise you to take only 4 classes per semester.
Okay, we have given you many uses of would. There are a few more, but instead of overwhelming you with information, let's look at some important elements to understanding would in everyday English. One element is knowing the connection between will and would. For a few uses, the meanings of will and would are connected. One example is in reported speech, as you may recall from part 1. The word would in reported speech clauses acts like the past tense of will in direct speech. The same is true when we talk about refusal to do something. The word would acts like the past tense of will. And in polite requests and offers, would is the polite form of will. But for other uses, there is no connection in meaning between these 2 words. It is also important to know that the different uses of would are unrelated. For example, the meaning of would in reported speech has no relationship to the meaning of would in expressing refusal to do something. To know what would means in a statement or question, pay close attention to the context as you did in the review at the start of the program. And don't forget to listen carefully. In spoken English, we almost always shorten would to just the letter D with personal pronouns. Now let's test your understanding again. I will give you examples. You think about how would is being used. Your choices are willingness or softening language. Listen.
The videos you emailed me wouldn't open.
I'd say that you need more practice.
We'd suggest visiting the waterfalls on a weekday.
I tried to return the coat, but the store wouldn't take it back.
Write your answers in the comments section. You can also practice by writing your own sentences. We would love to read them. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Germany's attack on Poland and the start of World War II in Europe presented a problem for Americans in September of 1939. The United States, by law, was neutral, and few Americans had any desire to fight in another world war. But most Americans did not like Germany's Nazi leader, Adolf Hitler. They hoped for victory for Britain, France, and the other Allied powers. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt made this clear in a radio broadcast to Americans soon after the war began.
The overwhelming masses of our people seek peace. Peace at home, and the kind of peace in other lands which will not jeopardize our peace at home. We have certain ideas and certain ideals of national safety, and we must act to preserve that safety today and to preserve the safety of our children in future years. That safety is and will be bound up with the safety of the Western Hemisphere and of the seas adjacent thereto. We seek to keep war from our own firesides by keeping war from coming to the Americas.
He praised the British and other allies. Finally, the president called on Congress to change the neutrality laws that prevented him from sending arms to the Allies to help them fight Germany. Congress agreed to change the laws so foreign nations could buy American arms. In the months that followed, Hitler and his allies claimed one victory after another. German and Soviet troops captured Poland quickly in September of 1939. Then Soviet forces invaded the small Baltic nations of Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. In late November, they attacked Finland. Fighting between Finland and the Soviet Union continued through the winter until Finland accepted Russia's demands. Fighting grew even more fierce the following spring in 1940. Germany attacked Denmark and Norway, defeating them easily. In May, German forces struck like lightning through Belgium and Holland. Within one day, they were in France. British and French forces were unable to stop the Germans from moving deep into northern France. The British finally had to flee from the European continent. They sailed back to Britain from the French town of Dunkirk. German soldiers marched through France, and Italian forces joined them by invading France from the south. Soon, Paris fell.
Thank you.
gilt den Verwundeten, die ihr Blut für diesen herrlichen Sieg gaben, der überall an der Front wie in der Heimat unbeschreiblich...
These are German newsreel narrators describing German troops entering Paris and the fall of the French government.
Der Ministerpräsident der neu gebildeten französischen Regierung, Marshal Pétain, hat in einer Rundfunkansprache...
A German supporter, Marshal Pétain, took control of the French government, and France, beaten and crushed, was forced to sign a peace treaty with Hitler. Now it was just Britain alone against Hitler and his Axis allies. Only the English Channel separated the British people from a German army that seemed unbeatable. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was forced to resign. The British people turned to a new leader, Winston Churchill.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. A tremendous battle is raging in France and Flanders. The Germans, by a remarkable combination of air bombing and heavily armored tanks, have broken through the French defenses north of the Maginot Line, and strong columns of their armored vehicles are ravaging the open country, which for the first day or two was without defenders. They have penetrated deeply and spread alarm and confusion in their track.
Churchill would prove to be strong and brave in the long months ahead. The British would need strong leadership. Hitler wasted no time in launching a fierce air attack on Britain. Throughout the summer, German and British planes fought above the English Channel. All of this military action had an important effect on American popular opinion. War and neutrality were no longer just ideas to be discussed and debated. Now they were real concerns, real events. Fascist troops, led by a dictator in Berlin, were defeating one friendly democracy after another, and Soviet forces were on the march too. Most Americans still wanted neutrality. But how long could America remain at peace? And was peace worth the cost of just sitting by and watching friends like France and Britain being bombed and invaded? Other issues melted away as Americans began to consider what to do about the darkening world situation. Some Americans, led by newspaper publisher William Allen White, called for the United States to help Britain immediately. But other groups, like the America First Committee, demanded that the United States stay out of another bloody European conflict. The struggle between those who wanted to help Britain and those who wanted to remain neutral did not follow traditional party lines. Some of the strongest supporters of Roosevelt's foreign policies were Republicans. Some members of his own Democratic Party opposed his policies. Even so, foreign policy was one of the main issues in the presidential election campaign of 1940. The Democrats once again nominated Franklin Roosevelt for president. The Republicans had several popular candidates who were interested in campaigning against Roosevelt. At first, it seemed that these candidates would fight it out in a bitter nominating convention in Philadelphia. But to everyone's surprise, a little-known candidate named Wendell Willkie suddenly gained a great deal of support and won the nomination.
For the building of an adequate defense, so that no dictator, however strong, may seek to strike, for the unity of our people, for calling again America to its great tradition of progress, I pledge myself to you, and I ask each of you to join with me in this great crusade.
Willkie was a tough candidate. He was friendly, a good businessman, and a strong speaker. He seemed honest, and he seemed to understand foreign policy. Most importantly, Wilkie had a progressive record on many social issues. He was not the kind of traditional conservative Republican that Roosevelt had defeated so easily in his first two campaigns. Instead, Wilkie could claim to represent the average American just as well as Roosevelt, and he offered the excitement of a change in leadership. While Roosevelt and Wilkie began their campaign battles with words, German and British planes were fighting real battles with bullets over the English Channel. Winston Churchill sent a desperate message to Roosevelt. The British Prime Minister said Britain could not fight alone much longer. It needed help immediately. Roosevelt did not want to take steps toward war just before an election, but neither could he refuse such an urgent appeal from the British leader. Roosevelt and Wilkie discussed the situation. Wilkie agreed not to criticize Roosevelt when the president sent 50 ships to the British Navy. He also supported Roosevelt's order for American young men to give their names to Army officials so they could be called up if fighting began. In this way, Roosevelt and Wilkie tried to keep America's growing involvement in the war from becoming a major political issue in the election. President Roosevelt won the election of 1940. He won 27 million votes to 22 million for Wilkie. This made Roosevelt the first and only president in American history to win a third term in the White House. The Constitution was later changed to limit presidents to two terms. Soon after the election, President Roosevelt received a letter from Winston Churchill. The British Prime Minister wrote that Britain urgently needed more arms and planes to fight Germany. Roosevelt agreed. He went to the Congress to plead for more aid to Britain. He said the United States should change its neutral policy because Britain was fighting a common enemy of democracy. Roosevelt also said the United States could avoid war if Britain was strong enough to defeat Germany by itself. Congress agreed, after a fierce debate, to increase aid to Britain. And in the weeks and months that followed, the United States moved closer and closer to open war with Germany. In March of 1941, Roosevelt allowed British ships to come to American ports to be repaired. In June, the United States seized ships under German control. It also took over German and Italian funds in American banks. Open fighting could not be prevented with this increase in tension between Germany and the United States. In September 1941, a German submarine fired at an American ship. The ship was not damaged, but a number of American troops were killed in other naval incidents that followed. By the end of 1941, the United States and Germany were almost at war. Even so, most Americans continued to hope for peace. In fact, few Americans could guess that war was just days away. The first blow would come not from Germany, however, but from Japan.
And that is our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from America and around the world.